I really did enjoy what Brother Garland Nelson said, and I was hoping he'd just keep speaking on that subject. I am honored to be on this lecture program, and I am honored to see so many of you that I've met in times past. Some of you have mentioned Sound Doctrine, a religious journal that we publish as somewhat an organ for the School of Religion. If you would like to receive a copy, write me your name and address, and we will be glad to send the copy. There is no subscription rate. We do have a kind of underhanded way of suggesting that you ought to donate to the school all along. Years ago, when I was enrolled at one of the universities, we students had a way of charging that the institution had set about to instruct us to forget our names and remember our numbers. Well, Brother Garland Elkins has written and in substance said, forget your manuscript and remember your subject. Now, at my point in age and life, I have no difficulty in forgetting my manuscript. My problem is remembering my subject. I'm somewhat like the man who said there are just three things he said I cannot remember. He said I can never remember a face. And I can never remember a name. And then he went blank and he said, and what is the third thing I can't remember? But I still retain my logical faculties. The other week I came to observe that I'd been wearing one shoe that's a lace, and the other one you just clip on. And I got to thinking about that, and I reasoned out that I must have two more shoes somewhere. And sure enough, I did. I propose to take advantage of Brother Elkin's instruction and thereby give my subject a little different thrust from the one contemplated by the subject assignment. Three of the four heads of the diverse beast, now that's my diverse beast that I'm speaking about, not Daniel's, as per my manuscript, turn on women to a measurable degree. Those three heads of my diverse beast are the ERA, abortion, and sodomy, and these represent the perversions that are so common with many women of the world today. ERA represents women's reaction against the role that God has chosen for the woman. Abortion represents women's desire to be free from the role of motherhood, even to the point of aborting a live child within the womb. And sodomy or lesbianism represents a recommended sex lifestyle as an acceptable alternate for women who rebel at the thought of pregnancy, motherhood, and the rule of a husband. The thrust which I propose for this lesson is to give some attention and encouragement for our good, God-fearing women. The general subject that has been assigned me demands, however, some attention to it first. The subject, how will society's moral revolution affect your future, actually imposes two questions. Namely, will modern society's moral revolution affect me? And if so, how will it affect me, whether for good or for bad? The answer to these two questions was given in rhyme long ago by the poet Pope. Pope wrote, "Vice is a monster of so frightful mien as to be hated needs but to be seen. Yet seen too oft, familiar with her face, will first endure, then pity, and then embrace." That Pope was essentially correct can be established by reference to society's immediate past. Some 20 years ago, Coach Willard Tate, an employee of the Alabama Christian College, related to me the details of certain ongoing discussions in a graduate course in sociology at a nearby institution. He reported that the university students were contending for unisex dorms, that they were debating the pros and cons of premarital sex, that they were asking why should college-age men and women refrain from sharing living quarters and sex together, that they justified their contentions by making reference to the liberties that were being enjoyed by young men and women of other nations, and for that matter, even by others of this nation, particularly from the east and way out west. These things will not come to the south, I averred, but you know, they did come, and they're with us today. To illustrate how pressing some of these matters are, Brother Demar Elam, a missionary in Hamilton, New Zealand, wrote of recent date, and here I quote, "The moral standards here are not what they are in the Bible Belt back home. For example, people here drink beer and spirits, as they call it, like we drink soft drinks, and it's not because the water is bad either. I've even seen children in restaurants being served their own mug of beer. It is quite shocking. As another example, it is a common practice in New Zealand for young men and women to live together in the same house or apartment, just as a matter of course. They call it mixed flatting. It is so open and so blatant, and those who look upon this practice with scorn are accused of being dirty-minded. The newspapers are full of advertisements such as, female flatmate wanted to live in with two males, or three males desire to have two females to share their large house. Needless to say, New Zealand has a very high rate of unwed mothers and women seeking abortion. I know that this kind of thing exists at home as well as in New Zealand, but the difference is that it is so open, and it seems to me that the country has lost its shame. They cannot blush. It is a good example of what widespread atheism can do for a country. End of quote. The case is that the fruits of the past 10 to 20 years in this nation are appalling. They consist of pregnant teenagers, abortions, and divorce. The divorce evil is rampant, with almost 2 out of every 4 marriages ending in the divorce, including even some preachers and elders. Hardly any home will escape the evil, either as an involuntary, innocent party or as a violator. No home is secure against divorce any longer. Those of us who have reared our children in earlier times and have seen them set up Christian homes cannot really feel safe anymore. For there are our grandchildren who are being reared in this kind of prevailing, permissive environment. Further, less than 20 years ago, I attended a meeting of professional school administrators and heard an educator from up east warn against the drug problem that was rising in the high schools across the nation. That educator warned that no high school or even junior high school would escape. He averred that even children from the best homes, Christian homes, would suddenly and unsuspectingly be found to be dope addicts. I rationalized again that such conditions could be bad, but they would never really come to pass, particularly in the Southland. But do you know, they have come to pass. The import of all of this is that in our society in general, and in all levels of our society, including all of us, we will be adversely affected to one degree or another with the course of the new morality. We must put forth greater personal effort to hold on to our moorings, and we must take more thought for and supervision of our young people. The new morality concentrates especially on women, with praise and admiration for the liberated woman. The characteristics of the liberated woman may be defined as follows. 1, she is an active supporter of the ERA. 2, she feels that God or nature, many of them will not admit of there being a God, has played a dirty trick on women by causing them to be susceptible to pregnancy, whereas men are not. She aborts, 3, without compunction of conscience, any unwanted pregnancy. And 4, she does not stop to scruple the choice of one of her own sex as a sex partner so as to escape the role of motherhood and the subservience to a husband. Women, however, are by nature more spiritually inclined than men. They are more idealistic. They are more sentimental. They are more humble. And they are more dependent. To illustrate, no woman, so far as the record goes, ever lifted a voice against the Son of Man. To illustrate further, there are far more women who strive with no help or encouragement from their husbands to rear their children within the circle of the church than there are men who strive to do so when in a reverse situation. There are far more women who are faithful to attend the church services than there are men. And when we get to heaven, if we do, we will find more good sisters there than we will find brethren there, I predict. The point to be stressed is that we who are men, including preachers, elders, and husbands, have really failed our good Christian women. Women have been imposed upon in the labor market. One great sore of our American society today is that women in great numbers have been impregnated time and again by no account men and have been left to fend for themselves and for their children. Even among our good Christian women, we have failed to properly teach, to give proper respect, and to confer proper, deserved gratitude and honor upon our worthy women. There are some Bible concepts which beg to be stressed, and they include the following. For one Bible concept, God created Adam and Eve as mortal beings from the very outset. Man has a mortal body, that is a body capable of physical death. A mortal body cannot survive short of certain strong physical desires, namely the hunger drive, else the individual would die for malnutrition. The thirst drive, which if the body were without, one would die in his own poison. The sex drive, which is absolutely necessary if man is to reproduce himself. And the achievement drive, which is absolutely imperative if men are to accomplish God's work upon this earth. For another Bible concept, God created man, male and female. This necessarily implies that God intended from the very beginning that man should multiply and replenish the earth. Else why male and female? The fact that God created man, male and female from the beginning necessarily infers that God had one role for the woman and another role for the man. One role for the male and another role for the female. For a third Bible concept, the role for the female was and is the role of childbearing. Thus, childbearing was not a phase of penal punishment which was placed upon Eve for her disobedience. I think perhaps there may be Christian women who have thought at times that they were being punished for the sins of Eve by their becoming pregnant and bearing children. In fact, of all of God's great physical gifts to man, only one gift, that is the gift of free moral agency for both man and woman, exceeds the gift of childbearing. Motherhood is the fairest of all of God's physical gifts. Unfortunately, many women have lost sight of the fact of this great gift. The case is that while woman was first in the fall, she is first in the rise of man. The old adage that reads, "She who rocks the cradle rules the world," is actually a true one. The woman's influence over society exceeds that of the influence of man. In short, just as the Gentiles as a race had a part in God's plan for man, so woman as the female has a great and significant role to play in God's family plan for man. Woman is so uniquely and beautifully fitted for her God-given role. Her fitting is beyond adequate description. The nature of the woman which made her more susceptible than man to the deceptions of the wiles of Satan, when exercised in a positive way, makes of her an angel of joy, an angel of mercy, a physical and spiritual fulfillment of the needs of both her husband and her children. The man by nature is unfit for the delicate love and training that an infant child needs and demands. None but a mother can give that love and compassion and security which children, particularly infant children, demand. Woman is the ministering angel to those who are in a state of infancy and childhood. She is the priestess of the home and of the nursery, and the child is a woman's most glorious possession, her most glorious trust. There is no end to which a mother will not go in the care and in her aspirations for her children. The woman makes the first mark on the helpless, tender infant. She sets the first seal, the seal of her heart and her character. She gives the first direction. She supplies the first want. She soothes the first sorrow. She eliminates the first pain. The all-wise God has committed to woman human life in its most helpless and impressionable state. Thus, woman, as the honorable mother, bears and gives rise to strong men, and of her own sex she bears and gives rise to benevolent and careful women, who in turn meet the human and spiritual needs of those strong men. For a fourth Bible concept, Eve did receive penal punishment for her disobedience, and that punishment has been passed on to her daughters. For God said, I will greatly multiply thy pain and thy conception. In pain shalt thou bring forth children, Genesis 3:16. The fact of this punishment cannot be denied, for no other female requires such attention and time and suffers such pain and inconvenience as does the woman in giving birth. God further said, thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. And the meaning is that though giving birth would be so accompanied with pain, responsibilities, and restrictions, the woman would nevertheless so strongly desire the cohabitation and communion of the husband, and to have children of her own, that she would willingly undergo that pain, privation, and inconvenience in order to have a husband and in order to bear children. For a fifth Bible concept, the role of the male was and is the role of authority, or more exactly and specifically, the role of responsibility. While the rule of the husband over the wife may have been to some degree a punishment for the woman, it was after all intended to be a protection for her. The principle is that in God's order of economy, authority must rest with the person or persons best qualified and sufficiently strong enough to administer the rule. The limitations of a woman in her childbearing, in her homemaking role, necessarily infers that man is the best qualified to assume authority for the home, to earn a livelihood for the family, and to lead in the issues of church and social life. The case is that with authority goes responsibility. And in the case of the home and in the case of the church, this is just as true as in the case of government. The responsibilities that attend the home and the church are grave, very grave as a matter of fact. And instead of women resenting the role of their husbands as those endowed with authority, they should be praying that those husbands will truly accept and justly occupy and administer the role of authority, which role demands compassion on the part of the one who administers. Then life would be much easier and less demanding for the woman. The majority of men in the church and out have proven themselves to be mice, not men. While quoting to their wives how that Paul talked, "Wives, obey your husbands," men do not assume the responsibility for the proper and just discipline of the children and for the kind of home regulations that God's word requires. Men, generally speaking, refrain from accepting the responsibility for the hard decisions of life. They have, in reality, abdicated the rule of the home. Men often run a popularity contest with their wives for the acceptance of their teenage children. Many a time there is the case when the wife who is worn to a frazzle says to the husband at the end of the day, "You'll need to speak to Susie. She treated me with utmost contempt today. And then you need to speak to Johnny. I told him that he could not go thus and so, and he went anyway." Now, if that husband is what he should be, he will stand up and be counted. But in far too many instances, and this includes Christian men and women, in far too many instances, he leaves all of these things for the wife, and wherever there are failures, he blames those failures on her. And our women know this. And deep down, even among our good women, there may be a kind of underlying sympathy for the women who have become liberated and who have moved out to such great extremes. Men spend more money on their own pleasures and indulgences than they ought, and often they spend money that should go for the support of the family. My wife was in a Bible class not too long ago when one young mother said, "You know, I just do not know how to be a good wife." She said, We owe bills we cannot pay. And do you know what? My husband came in the other day with a shining new shotgun that cost $90 to $200. How many men are there who spend their money for hunting and fishing when they should be spending on their children's education? I was reared by parents who had very little of this world's good. My father and mother owned a 40-acre farm. About 20 acres was in cultivation. My father never voted in his life. And growing up as a teenager, I observed how that certain men who did vote had county jobs. And I began to inquire why my father never voted. Well, the case was that in order to be qualified to vote, a person had to pay $1.50 a year. And if he got behind for 10 years, he was just behind that many dollars. And my father never voted because he never felt that he had the money to take from his family to pay his poll tax. Now, I'm not suggesting, my mother's still living, she's 84. I'm almost as old as she is, a few days difference. I am not suggesting that they sprouted wings. Not at all. But I am saying that there are a lot of fathers today who occupy the role, the position, but they do not administer the role. And this is one of the grave problems. The majority of the men in our society today have proven themselves to be mice, not men. Men have the distinct obligation for earning a livelihood for their family. But in far too many instances, wives are forced into the labor market, even when those children are small. And when their needs are delicate, they're forced into the labor market to underline and underwrite the needs of the family. The penal punishment of Adam was that in toil and sweat of the face, he should eat bread. And our teenage boys need to be taught early that earning a livelihood is the obligation of a man. And he must assume that obligation if it takes working at two different jobs. And I have very little patience for men who have their wives out in the labor market and who are clamoring for 30-hour weeks so they can hunt and fish and enjoy the various means of amusement about them. I have no objection to a 30-hour week if men will use their time to the glory of God. But 30 hours a week is not a long enough time for a man to be properly and rightly engaged. He needs to spend more time in behalf of others than that. And the wife and the children are his responsibility. Real men will prepare themselves well. They will work long hours. They will prefer their wives and children first in their expenditures. In conclusion, I propose three propositions. One proposition is that husbands have failed their wives far more times than wives have failed their husbands. That there are glaring exceptions to the rule will be granted, And that there are often glaring violations by both the husband and the wife will be granted. A second proposition is that good women in the home and in the church have not been recognized for their true worth. They have not been recognized for their true worth. They have not been given proper credit for their important work and role in the home as well as in the church. If they're sick to be attended, the good woman will be there. If there's work to be done that they can do in keeping with their propriety, they will do it. 9 times out of 10, women are more responsive in church work day in and day out than men are. And this does not speak to the glory of men. A third proposition is that women themselves are failing those of their own sex by their failure to impress the young women with the importance of their role in the home, in the church, and in society. There is no more an important member in the home than the woman, and her role reaches out through all society. My hope is that this lesson will serve as a warning to those of us who are men, and also as a source of encouragement to our good women who, in the face of neglect and little attention, stand by their role, bear the children, tend them and rear them, and all of the while eschew all of the evil that is being perpetrated by the so-called liberated woman. I thank you.